I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Richard Meyer, one of the world's leading architects. His projects include museums, churches, homes, federal courthouses, city halls, and university buildings. He was selected to design the $1 billion Getty Center in Los Angeles, the largest arts commission of the 20th century. To give you a sense of the project's scale, even the 39-foot architecture model had to be delivered on a flatbed truck with permission from the California Department of Transportation. Richard was selected among over 100 competing architects, and he worked on the project for over 13 years. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'd like to start off by understanding what kind of house you grew up in, physically.
The house which I grew up in New Jersey was sort of a typical pseudo-colonial house that seemed like every other house on the street. It was a three-story house. It had a center hallway. You come in, you either go upstairs or you go left to the dining room, or right to the living room, and the kitchen is then behind. So it was a fairly conventional house.
What did your parents do?
My mother did volunteer work of all sorts, and my father was a wine and liquor salesman.
So your house didn't necessarily provide inspiration for your creativity,
no,
did it?
None. Although it was painted white.
Oh. And at what point did you think, you know what, I want a career as an architect? How did that happen?
I remember I was around 14 years old, and when my parents' friends would come and visit, they would ask, what is it you want to do when you grow up? And so I said, I want to be an architect. And I've never looked back.
But how did you come to that, do you think?
I liked building things. I liked making things. I used to have a drafting board at that time in the basement of my parents' house, where I would make drawings and models of ships and buildings. So I was kind of tinkering around, as it were. So reading Frank Lloyd Wright's autobiography and books by Le Corbusier.
And you spent a little time in a traditional architecture firm, and then you went out on your own after a couple of years.
That's right. First, I began working in my apartment on 93rd Street. I slept in one room and worked in the other room.
You're lucky you had two rooms.
Yes. And they were both quite small, but it worked out well. And after I got a little bit of work, I moved 53rd Street to a larger room.
How old were you at the time when you were first starting out in your two-room apartment office?
I was 27, 28.
And when you moved to 53rd Street, you were among buildings. That block has a lot of McKim, Mead & White buildings.
It's right behind the Racquet Club, which is McKim, Mead & White on Park Avenue, a beautiful building.
So you were among some of the architecture titans. Did you think about that consciously every day when you were going to work?
Well, I tell you, it was a wonderful place to go to work because you had not only the Racquet Club and Lever House, but you had the Seagram Building across the street.
Which is Mies van der Rohe.
Yes. And it was, you know, exhilarating just to be there.
So how did you go about paying the bills in the early days? What were some of your first commissions?
Well, one of the first major commissions which I had was Westbeth Artist Housing, low cost, low rent, I should say, housing for artists in the village.
Now, this was in the former Bell Labs building.
That's correct. 13 interconnected buildings that were occupied by the Bell Telephone Laboratories, and which they had vacated to move to New Jersey. And these empty buildings were perfect for loft-type spaces in which artists could live and work.
Now, you were 32 years old when you first took on the project. Why did they trust you to take on such a massive responsibility?
That's a good question. Looking back, I don't know why they did. I guess it was because of my friend Richard Kaplan, who was involved with the Kaplan Foundation at the time, and who, in a sense, just verified my ability to do it.
Did you have feelings of self-doubt, or did you say,
no,
I could do this?
No, I never could. It was so quick and so hectic and so demanding that there was no time to think about whether you could do it or not. You just did it.
No navel gazing.
No.
You said you didn't have any feelings of self-doubt initially, but were there any feelings of isolation? Because you were the only one sort of drafting and creating these projects.
Well, I think you know, when you work alone, it's very difficult. When you get up in the morning, you have to make a especially when you're working where you live. And I remember very clearly at that time, I'd get up in the morning, I'd say, gee, do I take out the garbage or do I sit down and start working? Your sort of personal life and your professional life get a little bit mixed up. But it's a good way to work because it creates for you a certain amount of discipline. If you do spend the whole day taking care of your personal chores, you don't get a lot of work done. But it also, living alone and working like that, enables you to work all through the night, and you get a lot of work done.
And how did it affect your socializing?
That's a good question. It's hard to invite someone to come and have dinner on your drafting table. So what it means is, mainly the socializing is taking place outside of the workplace and the home.
Richard, I can relate completely. People come over to our dining room table, which in the day has CDs all over it and notes. And so I can relate.
Good. I think anyone who works at home understands, the problems, but also the pleasures of working at home.
Yeah, but in a way, it was probably nice and cathartic to get out into your own separate space.
It was very important for me to do that. It was almost like saying, okay, now this is, now you have to be serious, because after working alone, if you have one employee, you have a responsibility to that person and to overseeing that person.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the modern architect Richard Meyer, known for his bold white buildings and clean, simple lines. Another hallmark of a Richard Meyer building is the innovative use of natural light. Now, before you worked on the West Beth project, you designed the Meyer House, your parents' house in Essex Fells, New Jersey. And you were 29 when you did that. So they trusted their son to renovate their home.
Well, as I said, they had lived in a three-story house and felt that as they were getting older, they didn't want to walk up and down stairs so much every day. And they wanted to live in what they thought was a ranch-type house, meaning on one level. And they had purchased a beautiful piece of property in Essex Fells, New Jersey, and asked me if I would design the house for them, which I did. And it was a great experience, I think great for all of us, and truly indebted to them for giving me what amounted to as my first commission.
And in a way, it was an investment in you and showing their confidence in you. So they were complicit in this architecture endeavor.
Yes.
Any other early breakthroughs aside from West Beth that kind of put you on the map?
I was asked by some people to design a house in Darien, Connecticut. And that house, called the Smith House, received quite a bit of publicity and enabled me perhaps to do things that would not have happened without that notoriety.
So the Smith House, I've seen pictures of it, and it really is emblematic of your style to a large degree. How would you define your style?
Well, I think that there's a great deal of openness and transparency. Light is very important, and the way in which you see natural light, the relationship between the building and nature, the relationship between open and closed spaces, the sense of the landscape being in dialogue with the architecture. All of these things, I think, are very important to me today and were important to me at that time as well.
It seems that, yes, you do use incandescent natural light, and you kind of hug the trees around you to some extent. You don't knock them down. You embrace them and make them the middle of the building to some extent. But I find the white slabs incongruous with the natural environment, and I'm wondering how you sort of reconcile that dichotomy.
Well, architecture, I learned early on that the whole idea of organic architecture, or architecture which is made out of natural materials, really is not a valid approach, because the minute you cut down a tree, it's no longer organic. It's no longer growing. It's no longer living. And you had to, if you use it as a building material, you have to protect the wood. You have to stain it or you have to paint it. And architecture is made out of materials which are stable. You want them to last for a long period of time. So there's a relationship between that which is man-made, that which is made out of materials which will last over time, and that which is organic, that which is natural, that which is changing, and that which is all around us, the landscape. Mm-hmm. And it's this relationship between that which is man-made and that which is natural, which I want to heighten one's awareness of in the architecture. And therefore, the whiteness reflects and refracts all the color that's around you. It reflects the color of the day. On a gray day like today, you appreciate the drabness and the grayness of it. And when the sun comes out, the color changes completely. And so the architecture reflects this color and makes you more aware of the color of nature because of the whiteness.
Now, where does the whiteness come from? I know in 1917, there is a movement called the Dutch Distile Movement. I might be butchering that, but can you describe that a little bit?
The Distile Movement from around 1917 to 1922 or so were a group of Dutch architects that believed that architecture was really an art, and the art form had certain ways of expressing itself in both in terms of form and color. And it was very abstract in its nature. It was a movement which had terrific group of architects involved in it. The best known is Gerrit Rietveld, and even the Rietveld chair is composed of two planes, one almost vertical but diagonal, and the other one perpendicular to it. But it's very uncomfortable. It's not a chair you would sit in and want to read for very long. But it's a beautiful chair, and it's a work of art. I think that architecture, you know, has to accommodate to human needs and to a certain amount of human comfort. And yet, there can still be a relationship between planar surfaces and linear surfaces, between open spaces and closed spaces. And this is all a part of the thinking in what the project is and how it's expressed.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the architect Richard Meyer. We'll hear more from Richard coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Richard Meyer, one of the world's leading architects. He was selected to design the $1 billion Getty Center in Los Angeles, the largest arts commission of the 20th century. Richard was selected among over 100 competing architects, and he worked on the project for over 13 years. Now, your buildings demand a lot of attention. I mean, these white slabs are quite bold, and they're kind of exclamations. How much of your ambition is a need for attention or recognition or immortalization in a way?
Well, you know, at a certain point, you do what you do. If people recognize it, that makes you happy. I think for me, the greatest pleasure that I have is when I return to a work that I haven't seen in a long time, and I see how it's being used and how it's being cared for, and it really makes me feel good, I must say.
Yeah, but it still doesn't speak to, you know, the immortalization question. Like I asked Chuck Close a similar question, or he actually volunteered it, that the desire for an artist to some extent is to be immortalized so that hundreds of years after he's died, people can still admire the work. Is there any ego involved in the
process? Well, I think there probably is, but my feeling is, you know, the works, once you've completed it, has a life of its own. There's not much you can do if it's not well tended to or it's not well looked after. I had a project in the Bronx, which was a hospital for mentally retarded children, which was a superb building. And unfortunately, it was completed in 1964, I think. And it was torn down in 2004. And there was a movement to try to save it, but I didn't want to get involved in that because I felt, you know, it's not up to me.
Was it heart-wrenching at all?
It was. It was sad because it was an extraordinary complex and one which I was very proud of. But life goes on.
You know, you talk about building these buildings and you really have to leave it to others to take good care of what you've created. I've heard that you're somewhat of a control freak. Are you?
Well, a little bit.
What's an example of your being a control freak?
I had worked very hard on the design. We did a wonderful job on the interiors. Everything was thought through completely.
You're talking about your parents' home?
Yes. They moved in and they were very happy. And friends of theirs bring them a house gift. And I came to visit one weekend and there was an ashtray on a table that I thought was just the most ugly thing I had ever seen in my life. And I said to them, you know, how could you have this ugly thing? And I took it and it dropped onto the floor and broke.
It dropped or you dropped it?
Well, I dropped it. And they reprimanded me and said, you know, that I really had no right, you know, to do that to something that was theirs. And they were correct. And I realized, you know, that there's a point you have to let go. Mm. And that was a good lesson for me.
Do you worry about that reputation being detrimental towards getting work to some degree? Because
no.
When I'm building a house, I, as the owner, want to be able to make some decisions. And if I know my architect is a control freak, I might have issue with that.
Well, I think that people either come to me because they like what I do or they go to someone else. So that's fine.
I want to talk about the controversy surrounding your projects. And I'm thinking, for example, of the Arapaci
right.
in Rome, which is a museum that houses the Arapaci, or the Arch of Peace. Why don't you describe what surrounds it?
Well, the Arapaci is probably the most important monument in Rome. And it had been moved by Mussolini from a previous site to where it now is located next to the Tomb of Augusto, between the Tomb of Augusto and the Lungo Tevere, or the river that runs through Rome. And the monument was being threatened by the traffic that runs along the road, along the Lungo Tevere. The vibration of the traffic, the pollution that was just making the monument black. So I was asked by the mayor of Rome to build a new museum around the existing Arapaci monument. It was very controversial because it is, the first modern building in Rome since the fascist period. Rome is thought of as a beautiful city, but basically related to the past, not the present, not the future. The existence of a modern building in Rome made some people nervous.
Did you try to tone down your modernism to some degree to let it blend into the historical landscape?
Well, I think it blends into the historical landscape in a number of ways. One, in terms of the materials that are used in the building, the travertine. All of Rome is built out of travertine. Now, this doesn't look like the travertine that's been there for hundreds of years. It's a rough-cut travertine, a system that we invented, yet it has the feeling of stone and it looks like stone and relates to the stone of Rome. It's also very open, very transparent, and the scale of the building is really determined by the scale of the monument.
What is your reaction to controversy? Do you relish it to some degree? Or
controversy is generally good because it increases the public's awareness of what's going on.
So ironically, controversy is good PR.
this.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the modern architect Richard Meyer, known for his bold white buildings and clean, simple lines. Another hallmark of a Richard Meyer building is the innovative use of natural light. I'd like to talk about your process for a little bit. How has your process evolved from your 20s to now your 70s?
Generally, what happens is in the very beginning, I sit down with a small team of people, and I sometimes make some sketches. I'm probably the only one in the office that doesn't use a computer. And then we make models. We use models a lot. We make study models, which begin maybe 3 or 4 inches high, and then they get to be 12 or 15 inches high, and then they get to be 2 or 3 feet high. But the models are extremely important as part of the process, because architecture is a three-dimensional art.
Even though you had early success and recognition, was it a linear progression, or what was that like?
You know, as an architect, you get involved in what you're doing, and you don't always think about what it is you're going to do when that's finished. And so I went through a certain number of periods in which I didn't plan ahead, as it were.
What's an example of work drying out for you?
Well, in the mid-70s, I found that I'd completed a number of projects, and there wasn't a lot of work on the horizon. A number of my friends were going to Tehran and saying, you know, this is where the work is in the future. So I said, well, I guess I better do that. And I got on a plane and I went there. I remember sitting in the lobby of the hotel with a list of people that I wanted to see and giving the list to the concierge to call to help me make appointments. And after 2 or 3 days, I never got an appointment with anyone. And I said, this is not for me. So I got on the plane. I came home. I said, if that's how you have to go and get work, I'm going to have to do something else.
Now, Tehran, you're talking about Iran,
yeah,
of all places.
Right, exactly.
Did you think when work dried up during the 70s of going to a larger firm, or were you resolute?
No, I was resolute. I just didn't know what to do.
So what did you do?
Eventually, something happened here that enabled me to continue working.
You had a lot of commissions in Europe versus the United States.
That's right.
Why were you getting more work in Europe, do you think, than the U.S.?
I won a competition in 1979 to do a museum in Frankfurt. And when the building was completed, it was very highly acclaimed and was really one of the first modern museums in the post-war era in Germany, and a number of other commissions came as a result.
What impact did all of this being in Europe have on your personal life?
Of course, it's difficult because I would spend 1 week a month in Europe. And then when the Getty started, I was every month, half of the month in Los Angeles working on the Getty. 2 weeks in Los Angeles and 1 week in Europe every month didn't leave a lot of time for personal life in New York.
And were you married at the time?
I was.
Are you still married?
No.
So I want to turn to the Getty Center. The Getty, in some way, is a keystone of your career. Do you call it that, or do other people consider
it
that?
Well, it's a good question. Every time I go back to the Getty, I feel extremely proud to have been part of the whole process. The Getty was a tough project in many different ways. From the beginning, the community that lived around the site said that they didn't want to see it, they didn't want to hear it, they didn't want to smell it, they didn't want to know anything about it. And we couldn't do anything that they would be able to see from any location. And in fact, along those lines, one of the people on the committee that represented the community was very concerned about a public garden off the museum that looked out to downtown Los Angeles and from which you could see the Pacific Ocean. She said, you can't have that garden there. I said, well, why not, May? She said, because people will come up there and they'll look down into my backyard. Hmm. And I said, no, that's not, won't happen. So I said, why don't you come up to the site with me and we'll stand where the garden's going to be. And you can see what the public will see when the building's completed. So we went up there and I said, now, May, how are people going to see into your backyard? Where's your house? He said, well, I can't see it, but I know it's out there somewhere. But that's the attitude that you have to deal with in a project of this scale and this magnitude. And you have to deal with all people's different concerns about what it's going to do to their privacy and to their value of their houses, et cetera. The value of all the houses around the Getty went up tremendously, where they were afraid it would go down. Mm-hmm. The whole process is one which is very complex because you're dealing with the city, you're dealing with a client that has many different facets. It's not just a museum. It's a center for the history of art and humanities. It has one of the greatest art library in the world. It has a conservation institute in which works are conserved, not just artworks, but you know, how do you preserve the mummies for the next 5,000 years?
You talk about the project being very complex. What part of you, when you were getting into architecture, knew that you were going to be dealing with all these constituents versus just practicing your craft?
Well, architecture is a fascinating profession because it changes all the time, and there's no way that I could have ever imagined being involved in anything as complex as the Getty Center when I was beginning. It's beyond belief, and I doubt that I'd be ever involved in anything again as complex as the Getty Center. From start to finish, it was 14 years, and I remember the whole process of selection of an architect for the Getty was a long and arduous one, where, as you said, they began with 100 architects and then whittled it down to 30, and from the 30 to 9, and then got different committees to come to visit the office and see the work. It finally got it down to 3 architects, and I remember sitting at home one Sunday evening with my children having dinner, and Harold Williams, the president of the Getty Trust, telephoned and said, Richard, we've selected you as architect for the Getty. And I said, Harold, I'm delighted. And he turned to me and he said to me, now, do you think we can finish in 3 years? This was after taking 1 year to select the architect. I said, Harold, I don't think we'll finish in 3 years, but probably in 10.
Mm. And then 13 years later,
that's right,
you opened it. How old were your children when you started this process?
My daughter was 3 and my son was 5. I lived in a house that was on the site. We would spend all the vacations out there on the site, and they would climb on the tractors and walk with me through the concrete areas of the basement, which were emerging out of the earth. And so they grew up as the Getty was being built. I remember vividly one day when we were walking through the site, the building had been completed. And my daughter said, what are all these people doing here? This is our building.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Richard Meyer, the architect, very well known for the Getty Project, which cost $1 billion to build and took over 13 years to complete. I would like to talk about the Perry Street apartments.
Yes.
The Perry Street apartments are residential buildings of what stories?
They're 16 stories.
And when I pass them on the West Side Highway, I think to myself, well, why not make them office buildings? Because there seems to be a lack of privacy. And I was wondering, when you were designing the buildings, if that was a concern for you at all?
Not at all. You just have to pull the shade.
Was it a New York Times writer who likened it to a Rear Window Hitchcock's movie? So you could see Miss Torso doing her ballet. And has that been a concern at all for the potential buyers?
Actually, it hasn't been, because I think that, you know, if people want privacy, they pull the blinds. And if they want light and air and a spectacular view during the day, they leave the blinds open.
Some of the residents include Martha Stewart and Calvin Klein and Jean-Georges. How do you live? Do you live among space and light?
I fortunately have an apartment which faces south. So I do get South Light. And here, downtown on Perry Street and on Charles Street, not only do you get that wonderful light, you also get the light off the river and the view to the river, which is spectacular.
Do you live in a traditional building? What is the architecture of your building?
Well, the building was built by a wonderful architect named Borsario Candela in 1934. So it's a masonry building and well done.
I'm intrigued by the celebrity surrounding architects to some degree. And I look at architects in the same vein as I do restaurateurs, frankly. Has it always been the case that architects have been kind of civic leaders with some flair?
I think it's much more recent that this phenomena exists. And, you know, it's really due to the media. And I think the media has a greater awareness of architecture and architects today than it ever has before.
Although, you know, you go back to Renaissance Italy and you look at Brunelleschi, who is the father of Italian Renaissance architecture, and he was so revered during his time. And he was buried in the most esteemed chapel. I think it was Santa Maria del Fiore. So even he had a degree of celebrity despite the lack of media.
Right. That's true. I think architecture has always been one of the arts which has commanded a great deal of respect, as it should. But it involves not just the architect, but really hundreds and hundreds of people that go into making whatever it is that's being built. And I think that too often, the architect, in a sense, becomes the symbol of the work of many, many, many people in addition to the architect.
You have described some of your work as having Apollinean virtues of clarity and order and simplicity. And I'm wondering if you lead an Apollinean life, which means that there's a lot of discipline and self-control to some degree.
Well, I don't know how to answer that. There's not enough. Let me say that. Mm-hmm. Not as much as I think there should be. I'd like to lose 10 pounds.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
My guest has been the architect Richard Meyer. Coming up, we'll meet Jordan Casalo, founder of Skojo Foundation, which supplies low-cost eyeglasses in developing countries. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Jordan Casalo, the co-founder of the Skojo Foundation, an organization that sells low-cost eyeglasses in developing countries such as India, Bangladesh, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Mexico. Jordan also co-founded Skojo Vision, LLC, a company that sells high-end reading glasses to stores like Neiman Marcus, Barney's, and Saks Fifth Avenue. And the company donates 5% of its sales to the Skojo Foundation. Jordan is also a practicing optometrist in New York City. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica.
I would love to know the first time you came into contact with this problem of people having limited access to eye care in developing countries.
The very first time I had this experience was as a student. I was an optometry student back in the early 80s at the New England College of Optometry. And there was an organization, a student organization called VOSH, Volunteer Optometric Services to Humanity. And we as an organization would go down to underserved communities in Latin America. My first visit was to a community in Merida, Mexico, in the Yucatan of Mexico. And there was a line of 2,000 people stretching almost as far as the eye could see, knowing that there was a team of American eye doctors coming to provide them with vision care. And for most of the people, it was the first time that they had access to vision care. My very first patient was a student from the School for the Blind. I started to look at the boy. He was about 7 years old. And I started to realize that something was a little bit strange. And I realized this was above my pay grade at the time. And so I called over one of my professors, and she came over. And she looked at the boy, and she looked back at me a couple times, kind of with a confounded look in her face. And she finally looked up and she said, "Jordan, this child isn't blind. This child just has profound nearsightedness." So he effectively could not see beyond an inch or two beyond his nose, literally. And there we went. We looked into our library of glasses that were cataloged by Power. And sure enough, there was a pair that almost perfectly matched this boy's prescription. And so I was the lucky one who got to sit in front of the boy and actually bring the glasses to his face for the first time. And as I got a few inches away from his face, his countenance completely changed, that of a sort of a blank stare of a blind person to an animated face of a 7-year-old boy, and he just came alive right in front of my eyes. It was a very powerful moment. It was a moment that certainly changed the course of his life as it did mine.
This inability to see close up really impedes one's ability to work. What are some examples of your enabling somebody to see and therefore changing their economic possibilities?
Well, I'll answer that question in a second, but just to give you a sense of what I kept experiencing was that for each person, every person who had these terrible, profound blinding diseases, there were 50 people who were coming to us because they couldn't see up close to work and to read their Bibles. And so it was kind of antithetical to my public health training to say to someone who has river blindness, please come in, we have this pill Mectizan to give to you, but tell 50 other people, sorry, we don't do that here. And I kept seeing that pattern over and over, and no one was doing anything about it. We've seen countless individuals who have lost their economic lives because they can't see to work. Most people in the developing parts of the world will earn their livelihoods with their hands, and so they need to see up close. And the cruel joke is that after the age of 40, 45, after 20 years of mastering their crafts as weavers and tailors and artisans, they lose their ability to focus, and as their vision fades, so does their income.
What's an example of somebody's life you've changed because you've given them glasses?
One is of a woman in Latin America who came to us, and her chief complaint was that she was a very deeply religious individual who was 52 years old, and she brought her Bible, and she was complaining that she hadn't been able to read her Bible for 10 years. After a quick exam, a minute later, we put a pair of plus 250 reading glasses on. She put them on, and she could see the Bible again. And as soon as she saw that, she hit the floor, she hugged my legs, and she started to cry. And it was just a very moving moment. The next day, we came back to see some more people, and she was the first person online. And I thought, when I saw her, uh-oh, something's wrong. And then I realized she got up at like 4 in the morning to be the first person online. And she brought 17 chickens with her to provide me with a gift of chickens because I had changed her life. She said, for you, there may be just a pair of glasses, but for me, you gave me back my God. And
wow.
So those kinds of profound experiences. Other ones that have to do with work, we met a goldsmith in southern India. And as the night hits in India, the lighting is very poor, and he couldn't work in the evening. And during the wedding season in India, you have to work hard all through the night to keep up with the demand for gold and the rings that he needed to make and earrings and so forth. And so his vision faded, and his income over the course of the year was about half of what it was the year before because he couldn't work pretty much at night. One of his friends became one of our vision entrepreneurs, and he heard about it, and he got an exam, and our vision entrepreneur sold the glasses to him, and it happened right before wedding season again, and he was able to then work through the night, and he basically doubled his income back to where he was.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is a social entrepreneur, Jordan Casalo, who founded Skojo Foundation, a nonprofit organization that sells low-cost eyeglasses in developing countries. He's also started Skojo Vision LLC, which is a company that sells high-end glasses to fancy stores like Neiman Marcus and Saks Fifth Avenue, and you donate a percent of the revenue to the Skojo Foundation. Now, why do you sell your glasses to the people in the developing world rather than give your glasses? Why is there this emphasis on market-based mechanism?
We've seen too often development programs that utilize a humanitarian approach and are almost like a relief approach, whereby market-based mechanisms will often solve the problem more effectively. So there are situations in the world with Hurricane Katrina and such, where you need a humanitarian relief kind of approach to solve a problem. There are other conditions, like the need for reading glasses, that is not a huge catastrophe that just happens once and you need to pour dollars and resources into it. It's a low-lying problem. There's 700 million people who need it. And frankly, there aren't enough donation dollars in the world that are going to go to a cause like that. But there is a product. Our glasses we sell in the developing world for between $2 and $5. So it's affordable to most everyone except for the very, very poorest. And we do make exceptions. And so we just felt that market mechanisms were a much more powerful way to get this product to the market and to the people who needed it.
What are some of the problems that you're facing in the developing world? Are people buying them? No problem?
People are definitely buying them. I wouldn't say no problem. On the consumer side, when we first started this, we thought that this was going to be largely a distribution challenge, getting the product from point A to point B. And indeed, that's part of the problem. But as much of the problem is that it's really more of a market creation problem. In the poorest reaches of the world is a very fatalistic attitude that when my eyes fade, they fade. And when my hair turns gray, my hair turns gray. And just when things happen, that's just the way it's supposed to be. And not like here where if something doesn't work, you say, well, how can I fix it? Also, then when people are aware that this is an eye problem, then they think of glasses as a medical device, not as a consumer product. And people who do have glasses, the few that end up not working over time, they say the medicine has run out of my lenses. And they have that sort of approach, that thought process where this is a medical device and how could this be sold by someone locally who is just like me. So one of the big shifts that we're trying to achieve in the markets is changing the medical model to a consumer product model. And that's very much what happened here in the United States, that 20, 30 years ago, ready-made reading glasses were not available. They were not legal to sell in pharmacies and Walmarts and stuff and in places like that. And so some smart entrepreneurs started to kind of create a fact and start to sell them over the counter. And there was a large, big legal battle between the eye doctors and the consumer rights advocates. The eye doctors lost, and now reading glasses you can find everywhere.
Now, because you are selling these glasses to these people, are you giving them choice of, let's say, red glasses or blue, or are there aesthetic choices as well in the purchasing process?
We do have aesthetic choices and price point choices. We believe strongly that the consumers at the base of the pyramid are about as savvy a value-conscious consumer as you can find. These people do not part with their money easily because they don't come to their money easily. We've also realized that vanity is not monopolized by the rich. A great story to that effect occurred years ago when I was in Colombia. And we had this woman who came in. She had had cataract surgery, and they didn't put an implant in, and they didn't give her what they call aphakic glasses, which basically rendered her as blind as she was before she had her cataract surgery. And so she came to us, and she needed a very strong pair of glasses. And sure enough, we had one that was almost identical to what she needed. And it was a 1950s cat-eye pair of glasses on a woman from the Choco Indians. And we thought it looked cute, but the next day she came back and she returned them. And we didn't know why she returned them. And we finally got to the fact through the translator that when she got back to the village, people laughed at her and she looked funny. And so we've learned our lesson many times over that you just can't pawn products onto people who are living in the poorest reaches of the world. They too require products of quality and they have to look a certain way.
I want to talk about the logistics of Skojo's distribution process a little more because you empower a lot of women entrepreneurs in these countries. Why are you partnering with women to sell your glasses?
Well, the reason behind taking this approach very much was borrowed from what Muhammad Yunus and his work at the Grameen Bank and other people who are working in microfinance have explored and understood. Women, when they have access to capital, tend to invest it in their children, and they tend to invest it in health and education. Whereas when men have access to capital, unfortunately, less virtuous things occur, and the dollars often go to things like beer and radio. The other thing that they've learned was that women have for many years in these societies been charged with the task of making very little money go a very far way. So we've chosen women because of those two primary reasons. Now, does that create challenges? It does in some societies. We have found in all of the countries where we work that in each country there have been stories of problems with the men sort of getting in the way of the women's success. We found it probably the most profound in India, where it's gotten to a point where almost we have to couple the women entrepreneur with their husband or someone in their community, because it's really not socially acceptable for women to travel from village to village.
What are some other issues, aside from women being unable to travel by themselves, that are impeding them sometimes? I mean, is there any jealousy among the men that, hey, you know, these women are getting more money, they're earning more money or income than I am? Or is there any resentment that they're deviating from this social fabric?
Absolutely. We've had a number of our women, one of our most successful entrepreneurs in India, in fact, had to close her business down because her father just couldn't accept the fact that his daughter was outperforming him economically. We've had many husbands who've done the same with their wives. The other thing that happens with when women have access to capital is that the power structure in the family changes. And so women start to have more say of if and when they're going to have children.
And thank goodness.
thank goodness. So again, these are sort of the virtuous cycle of development that occurs, that when you give women access to opportunity and capital, positive things happen. There are also many men that we've encountered who see the merit in it, and they love the fact that their wives are doubling the household income, and they've seen the benefit.
Do you ever feel the compulsion to intervene? Like in this case, when your most successful female entrepreneur in India has to stop the business because her husband doesn't approve, is there anything that you feel you can do there, or you just say, okay, well, that's the situation?
Yeah, that goes beyond the mandate and dictate of our organization. However, we do, as part of our Vision Entrepreneur training, we do in Latin America provide women empowerment seminars and self-esteem seminars as part of our entrepreneurial training. So indirectly, we arm the women with some fuel to fight back, if you will.
You mentioned before Muhammad Yunus, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for his microfinance efforts with the Grameen Bank. And now there's this concept called microfranchise. Can you describe this microfranchise model?
We're not satisfied with selling a few glasses in a few places. So we started to look at how to take our blueprint and start to scale it and start to sell it to other organizations that could use our model. For instance, BRAC is the world's largest non-governmental organization based in Bangladesh, and they have almost a community health worker in every village in Bangladesh. These are women who have taken out microcredit loans from BRAC and started small businesses selling health products. We said, well, why can't we just take that infrastructure and add to their basket of goods one other really important product, which is reading glasses?
The concept of social entrepreneurship is really still a young one, and you are unique in that you are partnering your Skojo nonprofit foundation with the Skojo for-profit company here in the U.S. Can you explain that dichotomy a little bit?
Sure. I have a family of three. I've grew up in an upper middle class background, and I realized that life is expensive. And so I wanted to be able to provide for my family the same things that my parents provided for me, which is a great education and a safe and good place to live. And even though it sounds simple, that's pretty expensive these days to have. At the same time, I saw the power of the skills that I was acquiring at school, and I realized early on that that part of my professional work was critical to the development of my person and my soul. It was really going to be part of my legacy as a person on this planet.
So simultaneous with a profit motive, you also have the social cause.
Yes, and each one feeds the other. The for-profit, as we mentioned, Skojo Vision LLC will provide 5% of their profits, our profits, to the foundation. And the foundation, because it's an intriguing story, gets a lot of attention and provides the company with some wonderful press and public relations.
So how did Skojo get its first donation and from whom?
The from whom is the philanthropist, businessman George Soros. And the story is, at the time, I was the health fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And Mr. Soros was doing an event at his home in New York to try to raise awareness about AIDS and all the issues around AIDS. And I was one of the first guests there. And I got into his wonderful, beautiful home. And there he was with one other person. And I was literally the second guest. And he turned to me. He said, well, what are you doing? Skojo was on my mind to really start to do, and I said, well, do I give him tell them what I really do or do I what I want to do? And I said quickly, well, I'm here from the Council on Foreign Relations, but what I really am interested in is the fact that there are millions of people who are losing their economic lives because they can't see to work, and we have a very simple solution. It's just a simple pair of ready-made reading glasses. And he looked at me. He goes, that's a fantastic idea. And I said, I'm glad you think so. I think so too. And he said, you know what? And this was literally after the elevator pitch. He goes, I'd like to give $50,000 to that idea and tell Stuart Papran, who's one of his top executives at his foundation at the Open Society Institute, that I want to give $50,000 to this cause in Nigeria. So the next day I call Mr. Papran, who I don't know. And I say, hi, Mr. Papran. My name is Dr. Jordan Casalo. I don't quite know how to tell you this, but Mr. Soros told me to tell you to give me $50,000. And he says, hold on. So wait a minute. Come on in and let's talk. And we spoke. He said, I do really like the idea. I see why Mr. Soros was interested, but I would love to try this in India.
How much did that incident give you fire to actually pursue it?
It was instrumental, but frankly, I would have done it either way, but it certainly didn't hurt the momentum.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been Jordan Casalo, co-founder of Skojo Foundation and Skojo Vision LLC. You could check out their website at skojofoundation.org or skojo.com. If you'd like to listen to the show online, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.com. If you have questions about the show or an endeavor you're trying to get off the ground, please email us at talk@fromscratchradio.com. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.